And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Dave, it's a foregone conclusion, what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the hearing. We're going to talk about what you think the political impact of the hearing was and how they did, right? I mean, what is there to talk about? Unless you want to talk about people who think that Adolf Hitler was an inspirational speaker and these people should be in the Congress, like Carl Palladino in New York.
Well, let's stick to the bigger issue right now.
All right, let's stick to the bigger issue. The neo-Nazis who run the Trump administration.
Yeah, the the authoritarians, the fascists, and whatever.
Yeah.
And the hearing was certainly a different kind of hearing. It was a much smarter kind of hearing where they employed visuals and they used the people's own words, and they showed them actually speaking those words. That is really not just a clever way, but it's an important way. You know, there's certain things that are said, and as a lawyer, when you're trying to prove a case, it was repeated on TV by some of the commentators. You know, you tell people what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. That's part of it. The other part is the Frank Luntz part, which says that pictures and visuals are worth, pictures worth a thousand words. People tend to believe what they see, not just what they hear. And of course, there's also the scientific things. The people will believe a certain amount of what they hear, a certain amount of what they see. But when they see both see and hear things, they remember a far greater percentage of it. So it was a production. And of course, the enemies of this process try to disparage it by saying, well, it was a production, you know, focusing on that rather than the substance. But because they had a lot of substance, and there were certainly a number of revelations that we didn't have before, and there's some promises that are being made that we have to see what happens. Liz Cheney was the star, certainly, and they minced no words or no view that they went right after Donald Trump on this. And that I think that was important. There's one thing that they didn't promise. We could talk about that, and that's about the funding behind these groups and the rally and whatever else. But beyond that, I thought that they had a pretty cogent plan. They didn't do what a normal hearing does, where they give every member of the panel their 5 minutes or 10 minutes to read boringly into the record some statement, you know, and kill the effect.
Most congressional hearings are useless.
Yeah. Kabuki theater is what they are.
No, Kabuki theater is interesting.
Yeah.
The hearings are boring. Not these hearings.
No. Ben Thompson, I thought he was a little long, and, you know, he wanted to lay a predicate for it. Liz Cheney, you know, he turned it over to her, and she was obviously the star of the show. And she went right after the Republicans on this. That was one of the great lines that came out of it, that Donald Trump will be gone, but your dishonor will remain.
Right. That's the line of the hearing, I think.
Yeah. That was the line. The second line of the hearing, we could discuss it, I thought, was that Scott Perry and other members of Congress sought pardons. I thought that was pretty earth-shaking to hear that, considering they haven't been accused of anything at this point.
But they knew. They knew.
Yes. Scott Perry, we've talked about for a long time, about his his attempts to get Jeffrey Clark appointed attorney general or acting attorney general, and where that, but we now know where that fits in, and that's going to be part of the hearing coming up next week, or this coming week. I'm sorry, but we should get back to exactly what the hearing I think showed. You had some interesting thoughts about Trump and the parallels of Trumpism to certain other nefarious parts of our society.
Well, what people are forgetting is that Trump's political education comes from Roy Cohn, came from Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn was Trump's mentor. Roy Cohn was Joe McCarthy's lawyer as a young man. And he went on to his adult career as the chief advisor to the various mafia families in New York. His career was that of a homosexual who was a homophobe, a Jew who was an anti-Semite, a lawyer whose approach to the law was to work out how to frustrate the law. He was a thug. An intellectual thug. He was the kind of justice minister appropriate to any fascist regime. And this is the guy who taught Donald Trump, what's proper. And that's the guy that he's looking for. That's the guy he hoped Bill Barr would be. That's the guy he thinks Giuliani is, but Giuliani's too drunk to be able to do that. His incompetence, Trump's incompetence, Trump's ignorance, Trump's stupidity leads him to be surrounded by people like Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell, grifters from the word go, who are themselves dopey and who don't have either the insights or the ruthlessness of a Roy Cohn. And it was all made clear when Jared's image came up during the hearings, and he was asked, you know, what did you think about the fact that the lawyers in the president's entourage were kept telling him, you can't do this? He said, they were just whiners. They were just whiners. Isn't that interesting? Just whiners.
Yeah, well, I mean, Jared certainly came off as a real arrogant fellow. One thing about Trump is it's not just his incompetence, but he has this personality defect that really blocks him from being that effective, because it's this narcissistic, this malignant narcissism that all you have to do is butter him up and he takes you, he takes you in and he relies on what you say. He can't see the incompetence because he's too busy basking in the affirmation that he's given. The mafia heads were more ruthless in their, or more circumspect in the way that they looked at things. They didn't have. They may have had egos, but they didn't have that defect for the most part, and I think that's a big factor. He's been surrounded by people like you mentioned, Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell, the MyPillow guy. I wouldn't be anywhere near anybody's White House, and he's walking in and out of the place at times, and making the most outlandish sorts of promises and what have you. Letting that guy even in is something. Michael Flynn had some credentials, at least, but...
He had credentials until you started to look at what he was.
Yeah, I mean, talk about... you just wonder what happened with him, but he's another person that shouldn't be within 5,000 yards of the fencing around a White House.
Yeah,
in some respects, you could almost say he's a traitor to America. He certainly is not a traitor to the Constitution.
Well, they all are. They all are.
Yeah.
But that's the whole point, that they don't want this Constitution.
No.
What they want is the Constitution before the Civil War, the one that made sure that power was in the hands of white, male, wealthy people.
Yeah.
Right?
And yeah, and that's the one thing that I am disappointed in, because I don't think the panel's going to get into it again, is the funding. Who's behind this stuff? But, we should stick to what they did show. And what's the purpose of this? And I think in one sense, this is a historic narrative or a narrative for history to let people know exactly what led up to this. And they got into the January 5th meeting in a parking garage between the leaders of the Proud Boys and the leaders of the Oath Keepers. Now, we don't have at this point the nexus necessarily with the Proud Boys and Donald Trump directly that may come out. But, these guys, the fact that they were both together meant something. And don't forget that we do have a nexus with Roger Stone on them. And we do have Steve Bannon on January 5th talking about things that were going to happen, that were going to be wild, and they're going to bring things down the next day. We have reports from Robert Costa, the reporter who wrote that book Peril with Bob Woodward, who said he was in the lobby of the Willard Hotel, and there was a war room up there. I think Rudy Giuliani was in that war room, and they were plotting things for the next day on January 5th. And the one thing that was brought out that I thought was very important was the fact that on January 6th, when those folks got up there and were, Rudy Giuliani talked about warfare, and Mo Brooks was there with his bulletproof vest on, and Don Jr., and then Trump got up there and said, I want you to march to the Capitol, I'm going to be with you, even though he knew the Secret Service had nixed that. The fact of the matter is that the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers were already at the Capitol. They skipped.
They never went to the rally.
They skipped the rally.
Right.
And why was that? I mean, if this was, a spontaneous thing, why were they there? Why were they carrying tactical gear? Why did they have what they had? It was interesting. The one thing they didn't carry were their weapons. They left their weapons in Virginia. I saw something where Tucker Carlson said, well, it could have been an insurrection because nobody was carrying guns. No. there's no necessity for insurrection to carry that kind of arms. They were armed with other things. They were armed with sprays, and they were armed with handcuffs, and they were armed with rope to construct the gallows. They were armed with phones that were coordinating things. That sort of things I thought was important.
In history there have been more than one cases, more than one example of this kind of inactivity in Paris, and the storming of the Bastille that overthrew the monarchy. It was a gigantic gathering of people who came to one of the centers of the monarchy's power and occupied it. 100 years later, more than 100 years later, in Russia, the storming of the Winter Palace in 1905, again, a demonstration that went to a center of power of the existing government and tried to disrupt it, tried to take it over, and that was the attempt to get rid of that form of government. So storming the center of power, whether or not it's an effective method of actually overthrowing the government, it's certainly a historical example of how people try to do it.
Well, the beer hall push.
The beer hall push, yes, that's true. Right. There's plenty of examples. Plenty of examples. These are how a certain type of political group undertakes to do a coup, it's not necessarily successful, but that doesn't mean that that's not what they intend. They intend to be successful. They just don't know how to do it.
Yeah. There was also the question that's been raised about the role of certain congressmen, congresswomen. We've heard about tours that were given the day before, sort of reconnaissance missions, and the way that the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers went to certain doors of the Capitol, where they were perhaps less guarded or, you know, a less fortified type of thing. And I think the other bombshell that came out of the hearing was Liz Cheney's revelation that Scott Perry, and she said numerous other Republican congressmen, requested pardons during the waning days of the Trump administration.
Well, to that, the New York Times reporters Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns, who published a book called This Will Not Pass, Trump, Biden, and the Battle for America's Future, which has been, you know, well documented and was well received. This, at the end of the hearings, released an audio in which Representative Jaime Butler, a Republican from Washington, says to Representative Lauren Boebert, "You were tweeting out logistical information while the riot was unfolding. You were telling the rioters where we were." And she says, and he says, "Is it true that you were live tweeting?" You can hear this on tape, "that you were live tweeting from the floor, our location, to people on the outside as we were being attacked." And she says, "Yes, those tweets did go out." And so he says to her, "Well, then don't talk to us about security if you were telling the attackers where we're at." And then he says to the McCarthy, I yield back. I mean, that's a woman who does need a pardon. And AOC Esther, did you ask for a pardon? And she then talked about something else. She wouldn't answer the question.
She may need more than one pardon.
Yeah.
We had that, certainly. Now, in terms of legalities, one of the things that stood out to me, and it really has stood out to me all along. Actually, there's two things that I think are important. One is the ongoing probe of what happened in Georgia and the attempts in Georgia to overturn the election there. And of course, in that one, we actually have Donald Trump's voice being recorded.
Yeah.
But there's other things that are happened down in Georgia. We had the sudden resignation of the U.S. attorney there that's never been fully explained.
In other words, this is somebody who is part of Trump's Justice Department.
Yeah, Bill Barr's Justice Department. It was before Barr, I think, bailed out as well. I don't know why he would have done it, but the thing there in Georgia certainly is being investigated by the state. There was a revelation this week, though, and this ties into the other thing, that Georgia was one of the places where they came up with these phony electors. And that was part of this John Eastman plan. I guess what this comes down to is that having lost the popular vote and being unable to overturn that, having been unable to stop the Electoral College, they put all their eggs in this January 6th basket, in which Trump first tried to convince bully or whatever Mike Pence, tell him I'm not going to be your friend or whatever, and really threaten him at the rally, so to speak, to not certify the election. And when Pence indicated he was going to do that, what they wanted to do was block that procedure, which is definition of insurrection. It's a government process. And stop the vote, stop that from counting on January 6th. And then what Trump intended to do was say, well, since they didn't follow the law and certify on January 6th, we can now go back to the states, and the state legislatures, which we have corrupted, will issue new electors that will go against the vote count. And that, I think, has, with these phony electors, we've seen documents in places like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, where they had these electors, and they sent letters from on somewhat official-looking stationery saying, here's the real electors, or here's the alternate electors, or whatever it is. And in Georgia this week, it was revealed that these electors, who are supposed to meet in the state capitol to make it kosher, were told to sneak in. Don't tell the people guarding the capitol while you're there, which is an indication of intent. And then we all find out this week
that they had to go to the state capitol because the rule says the meeting has to be in the state capitol.
Correct. Correct. And then Ginny Thomas this week, we found out previously that she had written to asked two state legislators in Arizona to help overturn the election. She actually contacted 29 state legislators.
Right.
So we had all that, but I think that is a fraud that is much easier to prove and much more direct. And the question is again, who is funding this? Who is behind it? What went with the Eastman memo? This was John Eastman's brainchild.
Well, that was one of his brainchilds because he also had the opposite brainchild, right? Eastman prepared various plans. He didn't agree with one. He did agree with the other, but he had them both.
Yeah. And I guess the panel, the congressional panel, is going to bring in a guy who consulted or taught Eastman, former judge Michael Luttig, who heretofore has been known as one of the intellectual conservatives.
Eastman was the head of a law school. Eastman is not just some guy with a storefront office. He was the head of a law school.
Yeah. And that's something else, you know, that's as a lawyer is discouraging. These folks who seem to have no fealty to the Constitution, either its words or its spirit, that they and we've seen this in the Republican Party now with all these so-called bright people who went to Harvards and Yales and whatever, the Ted Cruz's, Tom Cotton's, Ben Sasse's, J.D. Vance, who just have abdicated and abrogated the Constitution in favor of power plays. That's all it is.
Getting a higher education doesn't necessarily give you good ideas or give you any ideas. The fact of the matter is, although, for example, in the Vietnam War days, when there was an enormous student movement against the Vietnam War for all the good reasons, the majority of students supported the Vietnam War, of university students. It was a working class opposition to the war that doomed the war. The troops wouldn't fight. They were working class people. So colleges, you know, the right wing likes to talk about college as a subversive left-wing enclave within American society. And point of fact is the role of a college is to train people to run capitalist society. And most of the people who graduate from college internalize the ideas of the existing society. And they are conservative people. They are not leftist revolutionaries by any means.
Well, but they also try to capture certain places like the Mercatus Institute down in George Mason University.
Yeah.
Give them and Hoover Institute at Stanford.
Yeah.
To give them some intellectual cover.
That's true. That's true. But even without that, the base of the graduates are conservative people. They're there to run society. They didn't get educated to overthrow society.
No. By the way, there's a couple things about that. But, you know, talking about cover, we need to mention Fox, I don't call it Fox News, but the way that they covered this, you know, they've, as Andy Borowitz, the humorist from The New Yorker, said, you know, Fox was disappointed that this channel interfered with their, that this hearing interfered with their continuing coverage of Benghazi. They covered Benghazi, the 11 hours of hearings with Hillary Clinton, the Jim Jones show, and all of this stuff ad infinitum. They didn't run this. They wouldn't. Every other channel ran this in prime time. They would not run it, and they counter-programmed with their regular staff.
So tell me, what's the reason that they should keep their license? I mean, their license—they don't have the right to a license just because they want to have a license. They're supposed to serve the public interest. If yeah. they're not serving the public interest in terms of defending the Constitution, why shouldn't their license to broadcast be revoked?
Well, their argument is this wasn't in the public interest, that it was a sham. And it was such a sham. But they went to such great lengths, not just to produce a show that diverted people's attention with Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity. By the way, Sean Hannity's name did come up in the hearing because he was one of those that was texting, you know, stop this riot, get the president to stop this riot. But they wouldn't even run commercials. For 3 hours on Thursday night, they ran no commercials because they were afraid that their audience might change the channel during a commercial and take a look at what was, you know, the truth of what was being said. that's very telling as to what happened. And I guess it gets back to, I think, David Frum's statement that the Republican Party thought that, they ran Fox News, but they work that Fox News worked for them, but in fact they're working for Fox, and Rupert Murdoch and this authoritarian bent.
That accords exactly with the political theory of most left wingers, which say that politicians are the handmaidens of the people who pay them to be, you know, to get elected.
Well. That's why there's so much money spent on elections.
It's exactly
right.
You see
that in Pennsylvania that's already flowing in. By the way, you talk about left-wingers and the anti-war. Out in San Francisco this week, they recalled the district attorney, Bowden, and he was the...
Boudin.
He was the child of two of the most radical members of the Weather Underground.
You can't blame him. You can't attribute to him his parents' leanings and point of view, because if you do that, what are you going to do about everybody else in the world? You know.
Yeah.
After all, David Horowitz, the teacher of Stephen Miller,
right,
a preeminent American fascist, had communist parents.
Yeah, he migrated from the left to the right.
Yeah. So you can't. Your parents are who they are, but you're responsible for yourself.
Yeah, unless you have the luck to pick some very rich parents. You know?
But you're still responsible for what you do with the money you get from them.
That is true.
Yeah,
that is true.
Anyway, we got three hearings coming up next week. We have plenty to talk about next week.
And plus, whatever else happens in the world,
nothing else will happen.
Well, we're going to happen next week. So.
See you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place.